Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by Mark Christensen from, I presume, San Francisco. Is that right, Mark?
Yep. The Union Square area of San Francisco. That's great.
Cool. We were going to be joined by John Flowers, but unfortunately, Gremlins snuck into his house last night and decided as a cruel prank that they would muck up his Skype settings so that even though he can basically hear us, we can't hear him. So unfortunately, we can't have to proceed without John. Hey, we've got a really good show to talk about this week, and I'm going to ask Mark if we can do something virtually unprecedented. I want to not give away the ending of this film. and the reason for this is that I feel that maybe a lot of our listeners haven't actually seen this film. Could be wrong.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, to be honest.
And it is such a good film, and I can't recommend it enough. And I'm not the only one. Roger Ebert reckoned it was the best film of 1998, that I want you guys to, if you listen to this, still be able to go and enjoy the movie without actually kind of going, oh, well, you know, it's ruined now because I heard the VFX show. So I'm going to try and do it without spoilers. There will be some spoilers, but they only spoil up about the first 40 minutes of the film because we're not going to give away the very ending, which happens in the last sort of half hour of the film. And we don't need to because it's such an incredibly interesting and jam-packed film. So I'm proud to say this is an Australian film made in Australia 1 year before The Matrix was made. And yet, in comparison to The Matrix, which went on to become, you know, iconically pop culture, you know, this really didn't find an audience, which I found astounding. Did you see similarities between this and The Matrix?
Well, yeah, didn't they actually share some sets?
Yeah, they did. True? It was shot right after the next year, and there was some stuff still here.
They're definitely both. I mean, they share a color palette heavily, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is Alex Proyas's film. It wasn't his first film. He did The Crow and a few other things, but it's probably the big film that really sort of, for me anyway, landed him as, wow, this director is... Well, actually, it's not true, actually, because he had done some amazing commercials work in this country before, so I already knew him to be phenomenally good. And I've got to say, the crew on this film reads as a who's who of cool people working in Sydney at that time. The DOP was Ross Emery. The guest DOP, I've never really seen a guest DOP before, was Andrew Lesney, who would obviously go on to do things like King Kong and stuff, huge stuff. The miniatures work was by Bruce Hunt and Andrew Mason, who kind of teamed up with Alex Proyas in the first place to make the film. Bruce Hunt did the VFX directing, and Peter Doyle was actually the creative lead. I think he was called the creative director at the company D Film, which no longer exists, that did the visual effects. And Peter Doyle would go on to be the head of the colorist team on all of the Lord of the Rings films and many films since. So this really is kind of like, it's not a student film, obviously it was like $27 million, but it's definitely a film that marked a great collaboration of a huge number of people that have gone on to do really big things internationally since. So I guess I've declared my love of the film. What about you, Mark?
I was had a reaction similar to what some other people have had, where I was a little bit distanced from it, and I think it was partly the story, which is pretty complicated for my simple mind, but also some of the acting performances, honestly. I mean, you've got a couple actors in here whose very acting style is rather distancing. I mean, Kiefer Sutherland in this particular film is that way. He's kind of Shatner-esque in his line delivery, and that's my opinion. And you know, anytime you get William Hurt, I don't know. For some people, that would be a need I say more. But I didn't get that pulled into the story. However, the look of it is really striking.
Okay, so I will say this. This is not, in my opinion, people say that it's a complex story, and it is a complex story, but it's not a complex story that makes no sense. If you stay with the film, it's a complex story that, it's not like, you know, sometimes there are films that you, at the end of it, you go, well, that was really complicated, and I had no idea why, and obviously the filmmakers never intended me to know why. The whole point of it was we'd never understand it. And this isn't that film, okay?
No.
It's complex.
It's an abstract idea,
yeah,
really.
It's a very abstract, very... But, you know, if you were the kind of person that liked reading sci-fi and you know, thus sort of getting into very complicated mythology-type sci-fi stuff, this film is uncompromisingly, you know, for the comic store book guy. This is like, This is like right. really hardcore. So I'm guessing that if you listen to this show, you could really like this film. But let's face it, it is inspired by kind of German expressionist Metropolis kind of film noir kind of stuff. Or I like to describe film noir with 80s haircuts.
Yeah. I mean, some of what kicked me out of the story was also, you know, any plot conception this fanciful has some holes in it that if you start to think about them, they'll throw you off. Whereas, you know, with this film, I think you just have to kind of go with it.
Yeah, but it's not... see, if this film was made today, I would be worried that they would have a rock soundtrack, have a couple of ex-pop stars in it, and there'd be some gratuitous sex and funky kind of... and those sex sequences would be, you know, narrated by a heavy rock track for the soundtrack to be released to, and it would be, you know, dumbed down, and it isn't. This isn't a dumbed down story. This is quite clever. And so if you like kind of science fiction, and as I say, I guess it's sort of a person that would read science fiction, so you really like to get engrossed in it. This is not the sort of boy meets girl happy kind of perky silliness thing. This is not Twilight, for example.
No, this is like some of your more highbrow Roddenberry, you know, more conceptual-driven sci-fi.
And, of course, being done in 1998, it was pretty much at the start of the digital revolution.
Yeah.
So let's discuss it in terms of... I mean, there are some many interesting things to discuss in this film, I think, anyway. Mm-hmm. But if you're watching the film and you're really hardcore, I mean, I'm talking really hardcore, skip the initial voiceover narration if you're getting it off iTunes, or if you're getting the director's cut, it won't be there. Because mm-hmm. the first 30 seconds to maybe a minute of the film is a voiceover narration that hints at what's coming. And the diehard fans, I mean, the real diehard fans, skip the first minute. And you don't... There's no visuals. It's just shots of... space basically, or sky, or, you know, nothingness, and over that there's some narration which, if you skip it, will not damage your understanding of the film. It'll make it even more of an exploration and more of a discovery. It won't ruin it if you do hear it, but that was a studio ad. It's not quite at Blade Runner level of the voiceover narration, but it's you can see it from there. And let's discuss the visual effects. So we have a world that turns upon itself and is turned upside down at the stroke of midnight. What did you think of the whole kind of production design and did it feel stagey to you, or did it feel good? What do you think?
I think it's stylish, and I had forgotten that there was such a style. Well, it just popped into my head, but I've now Googled it, and I guess it really did exist, the style of 90s noir, because the film really did look like it was from not this era and not exactly like, you know, 40s noir, but kind of blue-green Matrix noir, if you will. And to support that, it just, you know, it's a film with a lot of style. It has some really nicely composed shots. It's really well lit. It's very cinematic feeling film, if that word holds any meaning for anyone listening to this.
Yeah, it's the Matrix that came after it was kind of black trench coats and heavy-duty firepower. And this is not that. This is stylistic, but not branching into Uzi 9mm and stuff. It keeps more in the style of a very noir but deliberately mixed up world where, you know, you have different generations of cars, different generations of clothing. You can't tell if it's 40s, if it's 90s, if it's 80s. It's and, of course, that's part of the plot. It's meant to be disorientating.
Yeah. City of Lost Children is one film that you could cite that feels somewhat similar to this one.
It's funny, the literature does that. For me, I went to Brazil, and the film Brazil by Terry Gilliam. And sorry, yeah, no.
I don't know why that's so funny.
Yeah, I went to Brazil. Woohoo! But yeah, if you liked the film Brazil, you'll adore this film to death. This film is not as funny or as quirky or as downright just Looney Tunes as that film. But having said that, that film was incredibly complicated, Brazil. And if you see the director's cut, I think it's a masterpiece. And quite frankly, Terry Gilliam is, for me, just a complete inspiration, even more than Alex Proyas. I just think he's... we should do Brazil on an upcoming show. But
that'd be great.
It has miniatures heavily used in both films, and of course that's a link. And also it's a very stylized, very graphic In a sense, you've got a line from this to kind of Sin City and a lot of the almost the spirit kind of level of graphic novels, because this was, I wonder whether or not, you know, we could have got to the graphic novels had we not had some stepping stones along the way, like Dark City.
Yeah, it's a very different, it does really feel like it's literally from a different decade, and it is, so... but I do see the through line. I can see it. I can see a little Blade Runner.
Yeah, a little bit of Blade Runner. And like that Automat sequence where he goes in to try and get the wallet. I mean, that just felt like Brazil to me. That was like, you know,
totally.
Just the,
that was funny.
Yeah. And I'm such a geek that I notice things like, do you know that he was in room 614? Did you hear that? They kept on, you know.
No, I missed that.
Yeah, 614 being 614 of Genesis in the Bible, referring to go build yourself an ark. An ark made of rooms. And covered inside and out without pitch. So, yes, it's very deep, very... this is a film for Googling. And I must admit, I just liked... I liked so much about how... Like, even, like, let's take the what you'd call, I guess, a fight sequence on the... on the Shell Beach sign. Like, it seemed inventive use of A to B to B to C to D. It wasn't just your, you know, happens to see a hammer lying beside his foot and throws it and they all fall back on each other and runs away kind of. It was, you know, like, it's just inventive. It's like the filmmaker cared about that scene and how you would get out of the, you know, classic cornered sort of spot. And I just, I don't know, I thought that I just, every little part about that didn't sort of reek of just go for the cliche and the easy way out, you know. So so I like that kind of stuff. I like that there's the kid.
Although right after that, he is suddenly on a roller coaster for no apparent reason.
That's true. But the you know, the fact that the kid is the one with the blade in the death sequences, I mean, it's just really uncompromising. But I still tell you this, as much of a geek as I am, I was sitting here re-watching it going... You know what, the whole kind of strangest, it's all very, and I had flashes of Rocky Horror Picture Show and Riff Raff, and then it hit me like a bolt of lightning that I was looking at Richard O'Brien, the actor who played Riff Raff from Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, there you go.
And I'm like, how could I not have known that? How could I have not put that together when I saw the film?
That's funny, I didn't pick up on that either.
But yeah, wow. So Richard O'Brien, for those of you that aren't quite familiar with, you know, urban pop culture legend, cult status, the film that defined cult status, in Rocky Horror Picture Show plays the very handy man, and he has a almost near bald kind of hunchbacky character, but it's the perverse nature of the performance that Richard O'Brien gave that actually inspired the characters in this. And so Alex Proyas apparently contacted Richard O'Brien and cast him in the film. And he does it.
Well, I think some 22 years later or something.
Yeah, right? Tremendously great performance. Because I hope you'd agree with me that his performance isn't one of those that's what did you describe it as?
Well, a little stylized and distancing. No, I mean, and the you know, all of those bald dudes in this are you know, they're kind of in their own world anyway.
Yeah. So I just think that was terrific. And I should also point out, while I'm on trivia, that, you know, when the rich couple wake up, like they were the poor couple and they get transformed to the rich couple. I also noticed that the dining room set that they're sitting at, you know, the dining room, that's my friggin' China pattern my wife and I picked out for our wedding. It's like a Wedgwood one. I was like,
no,
yeah, how cool
love
is that?
Film.
Yeah, there's so many levels that I love this film at. It's just hard to describe. So let me ask you this, kind of a spring this on you, but apparently in 93, about 5 years after this film was made, Alex Proyas was talking to MTV and actually said, sort of surprisingly, that he'd actually considered the possibility of making a sequel to Dark City, one in which he kind of thought that it would be kind of cool to see what happened, you know, a few years or whatever on. And in fact, our hero in this film would become the bad guy in a sequel, because he thought that would be a really interesting thing to explore. And one of the critics I read was like, no, don't do it. Like, you know, it's a masterpiece. You can't ever go on. Would you be interested in Dark City 2, or is that just the worst idea ever?
I don't know. The sun would have to shine on that world, I guess. I hope that's not giving anything away. But You know, I could see it. I mean, the guy has got the similar powers, and he could turn them toward bad, I guess. I don't know. What interested you about that, Mike? What did you see happening if there were a sequel?
Well, I guess the thing I like about any film is when they don't just have happy ever after. And this, I'm not going to talk about the ending, but in any film, right, like you expect not everybody that's good to die, for example. Or, you know, that all the children that, you know, are at risk are not all going to get actually slain, or that the puppy isn't going to get, you know, throttled and drowned. And because, you know, and sort of you just think the audience won't go with you. And so I love it when anyone takes a hero and says, well, what if we could make them bad? And it's also, I think, tremendously interesting, just speaking generally, if you can get a character that is, to most respects, evil or bad, and the audience is rooting for them. Do you know what I mean? If you can master that art of filmmaking to have you rooting for the bad guy, I think that's a really interesting piece of filmmaking. So if he was to do that, I'd be interested in it.
Yeah, and I mean, similar to The Matrix, this is a somewhat, I think you could say, amoral universe in which it's consists of a lot of individuals basically trying to work their way through this rat's maze.
Well, what if Keanu Reeves in The Matrix got all the powers for being the chosen one kind of thing, and then decided to take over and run the Matrix, right? I mean, wouldn't that be an interesting third film instead of the one they made?
Right. Well, the fallen angel is always the more interesting character than the one who stays.
Hey, yeah. So getting back to the visual effects, what did you think about the miniatures and the general sort of, just sticking now to the visual effects?
Well, with all respect, the miniatures often, you know, I'm torn because, I mean, this film rides on those miniatures, and they did create a cool aesthetic and, you know, some really nicely composed shots, but they were often, for me, lacking in detail. So, you know, I was really, a lot of the time, I felt, and this is not even a slam on, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm expecting today's standards for that time. I think it was possible to do more of what I'm talking about, just the level of detail in them so that they scaled properly. And it was more the case with some things than others, but it was kind of across the board to me. A lot of the models smacked at that.
Yeah, I must admit, I would have said that it was 20-year-old models, not 10-year-old models. It felt to me like this was the B team of international model making. It's not that it was the C team or the D team, but it just didn't have that ILM. Because you look at some of the films from the 80s, yet alone the end of the 90s, and you know, you have such impressive miniatures work that you kind of just am in awe of it. And I, looking at this now, I'm not in awe of the miniatures work, and I don't think it's the photography. I think it's, as you say, it's the actual quality of the set miniature building pieces, if that makes sense.
Now they may have just bit off more than they could chew, because there's a heck of a lot of them in here. And as you say, ILM tended to set a standard that, you know, at a scale that was hard to reach. In this film, they're building a whole world largely out of miniatures, so they had a lot of them to do, that's
and
for sure.
$27 million isn't a vast amount of money.
No.
And so even you know, going back a few years, like a $30 million film 10 years ago was a good, sensible Hollywood film, but not, you know, your big blockbuster. I think we got used to the $100 million to make a film these days, but definitely back then. You know, $30 million would, I guess, be by today's standard, what, $60 or $70 million film. And and at that level, I felt the miniatures just weren't, the depth was a problem, the detailing was a problem, but also I think the what really sells, really sells, like an ILM, or I should say Kerner Optical kind of miniature, is they tended to always find ways of putting people and actual live action bits, even if it was optically printed, into the backgrounds. And so they have enormous amounts of depth, whereas some of these shots, it just felt like we were sans actors because it was a miniature shot, and then in a minute we'd cut back to the actors on a set. And you know what I mean? Like, it didn't have that overlap where... Look at Star Wars 77, right? When Obi-Wan Kenobi goes around the side to turn off the, you know, tractor beam, you've got a matte painting that worked much, much better than the miniatures here, because you're looking at Obi-Wan and they've extended the matte painting out and up to give you, you know, this huge sort of canyon-like hole beneath him. And obviously you imagine a huge you know, amount of height above him, and yet you buy it because it's principally focused on the action of him switching off the button and not on just a blank environment where he will go. And I think that's what I had a problem with here, is that you tended to get a shot of a bunch of buildings with some lights moving or a train moving in the sort of background. But I wanted to see people in carriages let's talk about The Abyss, right? The Abyss did a terrific mm-hmm. job with, you know, that projectors inside the subs. Had you not seen anyone inside the subs, then they'd just been miniatures moving around. You would have been harder, I think, to buy those miniatures. Your brain kind of, you know, starts seeing the seams. And that's what was hurting me in this one.
Yeah, a couple other things about that. If I had to build a model shop from scratch and do ILM level work, I'd be pretty scared because that's very skilled work. This film really wanted you as the viewer to pay attention to detail. It's, you know, very psychological and, you know, well-composed shots. And so that also worked against them. But having said that, I mean, there's also basically a Star Destroyer type of model in this film. And if you just look at that one element, it's missing what, I don't know whether George Lucas's technical term, I've forgotten whether he called them Nernies or Greeblies. We used to use both, but I think he called them Nernies. But on the Destroyer, it's all that little, I mean, even if it's going to be a kit model or kit mash model or a model, I mean, that's obviously not how they made them completely. But if you're going to do a physical model, you're going to put those things on it that indicate scale that just weren't on this model. They're just not there.
No, it looked, it looked like a 20-year-old effort, not a, and even as I say, 20-year-olds would take you back to like Star Wars was 77. And,
right.
And I don't think you would say,
set. Yeah,
if you were to,
so it's almost like it was built by somebody who didn't really know the rule. In other words, they had to, I mean, my guess is they had to pull in some people who didn't particularly have experience with this and have them build a hell of a lot of models.
Yeah, I think we were in an age when you tended to be less international. I don't mm-hmm. think, thinking back
yeah, right.
then...
Yeah, you're not going to pull people down to Australia from
no,
LA or...
No, it wasn't that kind of an environment. It was like you'd get the local guys and say, well, let's try tackling giant miniatures. No one's done those.
You know how to do drywall? How about building this?
Well, I think it was probably commercials guys or something.
Yeah, right.
Now, I will say that my criticism isn't leveled at the photography because I do think that the DOP... and in the team that was doing the photography of the sets. And, you know, there are some bits that work really well, like when they're beneath in the where the machine is and stuff starts there and starts swirling and twisting to come up, mm-hmm. it has enormous, you know, detail and looks really good at that scale. It's just that when you mm-hmm. cut to the above shots, hampered, of course, because everyone's meant to be asleep, you just have these twisting buildings and the shots to me just didn't sell and didn't scale the way they should, and you know that cuts me to say that because obviously I like the film so much.
They could have helped themselves with using depth of field a little bit more too, because a lot of these shots are resolved more like Citizen Kane than you know, if I were faced with this problem, not that I'm a DP, I would definitely put things in shallower focus and
except for the fact that you mean like you'd have an actor in the foreground and a miniature happening behind them out of focus? Because obviously depth of field fights
pure,
against miniature.
These are your shots that you were speaking of where you're obviously looking at a model and not putting anybody in it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, today obviously you do all of that
this
digitally.
This is armchair quarterbacking. It's not really fair.
So. Totally. but, you know, like we... I mean, we're not saying the film is bad. We're not even saying that the visual effects were bad. We're just saying that the miniatures were probably the weakest link. And I think it's actually quite an interesting to... and I actually find this a very important skill for a VFX supervisor to look at a shot and be able to tell you what's wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're listening to this, you might sound like we're being, you know, just complete bastards and like... You
no,
know,
I think it's absolutely worthwhile to still frame on this show and take a look and... try to figure out why, you know, why the scale reads the way it does. And
I mean, if you were
make your own opinion.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, you know, cut them some slack, you do better kind of thing. But in fact, the way you do better is to be able to look at a shot, sit there and actually pick it apart and say, okay, so the I don't know, the color in the blacks is not matching the sky and that's what's wrong with this shot. And if you can't say that, if you just say it looks fake, that's, I guess, more the quarterback armchairing that is less constructive. But on a real project, for example, Mark, if you and I are working together on this, I would love to show you a shot and say, what's wrong with this?
Do you buy
and,
it? Yeah.
And then get your kind of critical eye to say, okay, I think this would help sell the shot and this is not what's working for me. And if you can articulate that, that is the most useful skill for a supervisor.
Yeah, I think the audience's eyes have even become more attuned to some of this. Turning to the comps in this movie, some of them are very A over B in a way that you just wouldn't get away with anymore, I thought.
Interestingly, this was done by D-Film. So D-Film was a new company set up, and the idea was to take a model of it's quite controversial, I guess, in one sense, because they took the model of E-Film in Los Angeles and said, well, let's try doing that ourselves, and they decided to call themselves D-Film. Yeah, and they weren't, I don't think, deliberately trying to trade on that this was the, you know, Australian arm of the E-Film company or anything like that. No one was pretending that that was the case. But it was this notion that you would have a digital versus analog or traditional optical approach, and you'd go all digital. And when they were doing this in obviously they must have started it a year or two before the film came out, that was pretty revolutionary because it was happening in commercials, but not at a feature film level. And great, great companies like Animal Logic, for example, were still doing things like title sequences for Babe, but not actually doing vast, you know, 100 shots of digital effects. I mean, just to set the clock at the point we were at. So So D-Film was operating in an environment where every company didn't do feature film or visual effects, and they certainly didn't do them digitally, and it was just the start of the digital kind of revolution. And so they were pioneering in that respect. So there was a lot of stuff to do with, for example, 10-bit Cineon workflows and just digital workstation work that really was stuff that they were pioneering in this part of the world. I mean, Weta didn't exist back then. As I said, Animal Logic was here doing great work, but again, not doing major feature film visual effects, doing more commercials and stuff. And it was just at a period when, you know, everyone was trying to sort of establish this. And so the company served its purpose, I guess, in that it really gave a leg up to the local industry. But having said that, you can't give them points for merit. If you're looking at the film, you have to sort of say, does it work or not? I think there are some parts that worked.
Absolutely. And it's more broadly true just of films in this era. I mean, we could look at the Academy Award winners from the same time and level similar critiques. So all I'm saying is, I mean, while the effects people have gotten better at doing this stuff and seeing it, I think the audience also has become more attuned.
Yeah, but I'm thinking to myself now, what would be a comparative film from the same period that would have a lot of miniatures in it, for example?
You could say Titanic, I suppose.
I think this is significantly pre-Titanic, right? I think
it's only, well, actually, I mean, it was released a year later, right?
Than Titanic?
Yeah, isn't Titanic 97?
Really? Wow, that's true. I was thinking Apollo 13 myself, was 95.
That's quite a bit before, yeah.
I guess also the thing about, Dark City's 98, Titanic, Apollo 13 was 95. That lost out to Babe in the Oscars, though. I've said often, I think that, no offense or anything, but I think Apollo 13 was magnificent. But it had a lot of miniatures in it. And certainly the miniatures in Apollo 13 were just beyond seamless, right?
Yeah, I mean, really good. Absolutely.
I think about Titanic, I guess, is that, yes, it was 97, but of course it had an astonishingly bigger budget than the $27 million in...
I think a lot at the time, I think there was some comparison maybe of this film to, say, the Batman series, which was flagging under kind of similar difficulty. And this film has much more vision to it, I think, than Gotham had in the 90s Batman movies.
Though I remember a similar actual concern about the miniatures in the Batman film that had the Penguin. Now, which one was that? Was that 96 It was a 96 Batman.
Yeah, and, now you got me on thin ice.
Now I got you on thin ice.
I hope it wasn't Batman and Robin. Did it have Arnold Schwarzenegger in it too?
No. It was Danny DeVito, right, was playing Penguin.
Right, okay, so that was the second one.
But I remember that had something in Batman Returns, right?
Yeah, I was going to say Batman Returns, but I was afraid I was going to get it confused with Batman Begins. Yes.
Okay, and Batman Returns was 92, and I didn't myself. I remember, you know, some of the sort of Gotham shots and that weren't working as. But of course, that's still 6 years earlier than what we're talking about. So, yeah. The thing I guess in miniatures, they didn't or never have advanced at the same rate of knots that digital effects have. Do you know what I mean? Like 3 years in digital effects is, or maybe 5 years is an enormously long time. Whereas I think in miniatures, it didn't leap and jump at the kind of same dramatic rate that.
Well, and that's a good point for this film as well. We haven't talked about the just pure CG in this.
Well, you're absolutely right. I sort of hinted at it because that that sequence that I referred to, where the sort of cascading or cantilevered forming of the building was a digital shot, which I thought worked really, really well. And and I guess you're absolutely right. For me, the digital shots actually worked better than the miniature shots. But what about you?
Well, some of them look really cool. They date themselves in terms of, you know, they were going for a pretty high mark on this in terms of what they were trying to do, which is a lot of transformation stuff. And that was hard to do at a time where, you know, these are cumbersome animations, so you don't get the snappy kind of response on your workstation to, you know, make them interesting. And I think the animation was often done really by TDs. So it was kind of like, some of them look like, you know, somebody slid a slider. And, you know, that sounds like a harsh knock, but actually they look really cool, a lot of them, you know, and they just date themselves a bit at times. Some of the stretchy, wobbly stuff, too. It's like I don't know, Mike, did you feel like they could have broken it apart a little bit more to just make it a little more? It's kind of like the miniatures where it needed a little more detail and not a lot, but you would just... It's like one thing was happening in the shot as opposed to two or three. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Of course, with the time they were doing this, we hadn't even got ambient occlusion and stuff. So getting that realism, at least it was dark, right? That helped a lot.
Yeah, oh, and I know. And they're doing crazy amounts of warping and kind of morphe.
But, you know, the staircase growing dissolved. From the Stranger's Lair is the shot that I've been referring to. And that, I think, really worked. And it was the above stuff that maybe didn't kind of gel so well. But I think you're right. I think also that if you remember back, doing 10-bit cinema 2K stuff back then was absurdly high res and digitally. And the problem you have is the time it took to iteratively do those and do film outs and stuff. And
Not to mention trying to do it without OpenGL. You know, it's tough.
Yeah, so it really was kind of a difficult problem. I don't know. I think...
some really cool stuff. And again, I mean, you give them credit for going for it. You know, like, they were pretty fearless. Again, I mean, probably a budget thing and probably all the other things. But they went for a really certain type of vision. And because so much of the stuff is this psychokinetic power... plot line, you have to do that. You have to make the world kind of go crazy, kind of like the Matrix.
But I don't think even though maybe some of the stuff, it looks a little dated. I don't think, and of course, I guess there are even shots in Blade Runner that I, you know, looking back now, feel sort of miniaturesque. I don't think my admiration for the film is like, whereas Blade Runner was the definitive vision of the future, this had a great art direction, but for me, I just got pulled in by the complex and unfolding plot lines and the kind of cool visual style. I think, you know, like Blade Runner was iconic images. Like there are shots that you think of that and you just go, if I did that today, I'd be bloody happy with it. But I wouldn't.
You did one of those today, right?
But I wouldn't want to put that off. I wouldn't want to put somebody off in thinking that if you looked at the film, you're going to like laugh at the effects and just say they look really hokey and crap.
No,
it's not that at all.
I think here's the point I really want to make. I mean, again, comparing this to The Matrix, which, you know, they have in common that they're taking the physical world and saying that it's actually slightly imaginary, and there's this reality behind it that comes. You know, the mind has the power to transform it. And in The Matrix, that had very, it had very specific physical objects that were motivating that. And so the physical animation and the warpiness and all was tied to that. Whereas in this film, it didn't, they didn't do that, and it didn't make the world feel as much like, it didn't give me the feeling that, oh my gosh, the whole world is this crazy illusion, which is, it has thematically that in common with The Matrix, I think, although in The Matrix, that's really at the heart of the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that The Matrix, the first one, had that iconic visual effects thing, like the bullet time that just made you
go... So a bullet ripping through the air as the motivation to warp, you know, the reality around it, right?
Yeah.
You know, it just, it grounds the effect in a visual way that is more powerful than seeing the whole whole frame go wobbly, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think if you haven't seen the film, if you don't go in expecting it to be, you know, better than anything you've ever seen before in your entire life.
Well, and it's not cheap really looking. Enjoy it. I mean, yeah, it's a sumptuous experience. Our nitpicking about certain things is not fair in terms of how rich a story and a visual experience this movie is.
Yeah. If you want to sort of, if you're that sort of person that reads a great novel or listens to a band and then says, oh, I'd really like to see what their early work is. You know, like quite often with a band, you'll go, this is so cool. You'll go back to their early work and maybe it's not as polished and maybe it's not as, as slick and professional as what you're getting now, but it's magnificent to discover the early material. And yes, the recording quality is maybe not quite as perfect as the mix that you're getting today when they have a lot more money, but, you know, it is somehow honest and incredibly, you know, cool to hang and listen to. And certainly that's how I feel about this film. If you thought The Knowing was interesting, this is vastly more interesting in that same tangent that you can, you know, if The Knowing was turning things on its head a bit, boy, Dark City just gives you the friggin' roller coaster of turning things on its head. Well, next week we're going to be, well, next couple of weeks actually, we're swinging back to new films. We've got coming up in the pipeline both Wolverine and Star Trek, the new film. I don't know if you've seen either of those just yet. They're only just opening as we record this, Mark.
Yeah, I would be very privileged to have seen either of them, and I may have to get lucky just to see Star Trek in the first week in this town. It's a hot ticket.
I must admit, I got an advanced screening a while ago, and and over at FX Guide TV, we actually have an interview I did with J.J. Abrams, who's a hell of a nice guy, by the way.
God, it's going a great interview, man.
Oh, yeah, it's a really good interview. And what's fun about it is that he discusses what I would describe as a very funny old-school approach to some of the visual effects that I was caught quite off my guard. And I think maybe it was because a lot of the interviews he'd been doing had focused on, you know, the history of Trek, and I wasn't there for that.
Yeah,
we
you
got into
a break
a very
from that. That's
yeah,
cool.
We got a really interesting side story, which is actually a very funny anecdote. So, but that's all coming up, and Wolverine, of course, X-Men Origins. It'd be interesting to see if that film scores, because if it does score an audience, then I can imagine there'll be a bunch of Origins films coming out.
Yeah.
And that's a film that Hugh Jackman, I believe, actually invested some of his own money in. He believes in it so much. So,
Okay.
Another another couple of great films coming up for us to review. And, of course, our apologies for... Well, not really our apologies, our
condolences.
Condolences to John for sitting at home quietly. He did actually rush back to the recording studio at his office to do this recording. I'm sorry that Skype let him down. Do you want to do our thanks and credit run?
Uh-oh. All right, I'll give it a try. So we're going to thank Laurie Apthorpe and Kristen Martin.
So Laurie did a great piece of research on digging up stuff on the film.
Yeah,
and we appreciate that. And KM does our producing and work, and also runs the website vfxshow.com, where you can check out notes or anything from the film. Also, you can find us, of course, on iTunes. You've probably already done that, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to us. And you're on the Twitters, Mark.
Yep, Flow Seeker over there.
And also, I noticed you've been quite active over at Pro Coalition.
You know, I've been doing a tip a day this month. That's going to be over by the time people are listening, so I may be back to being a deadbeat by that point. But I did kind of muscle up because I owed those guys. Yes.
Yes, I think you were even doing some red tips. I was quite pleased to see.
Yeah, that is correct. You learn by writing in many cases, and I've a lot of what I know I've learned from FX PhD, Mike. So thank you.
I'd have to say, if you really want to learn, try teaching because
exactly.
It's amazing, isn't it? You go, I'm going to discuss now about why the red log color space doesn't match perfectly to print stock, and then you go, I thought I understood
Suicide
that, but
mission.
Actually,
yeah.
I just wanted to. Why is it 95 on the pedestal? And you start pondering that, and then you research it yourself, or somebody asks you a question. Somebody asked me a great question the other day that I'm in the middle of researching, which is, what are the optimum settings for turning red footage into black and white? And I'd never stopped to think about that. And so it's great doing that kind of stuff, and we appreciate it. I'm obviously on the Twitters as well as Mike Seymour. And
I'm going to actually throw in as well, I've had the opportunity to VFX supervise on a feature. It's a very small one with a very meager number of visual effects, but it's really fun with Hollywood talent on a low budget here in San Francisco. So it's called All About Evil. I can't tell you when you'll be able to see it because it's probably going to go this festival circuit and it needs to find a distributor, but I'm confident it will. It's got a lot of things going for it.
Can I ask you a question about that? Because obviously just been supervising in London myself, I found I just completely relied on my stills camera. I couldn't get over how much I was relying on and how much I used stills photography on something that wasn't really, obviously some bits were I intended to get textures and stuff. Do you find yourself walking around on set? I mean, I know your genre is horror, but...
No, absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you a story. There was one shot that I had to deliver during production because this is a movie within a movie. And one of the shots never appears in the film, but it had to be projected behind or on top of a couple of the actors in which an area of the backstage just goes up in flames. So that was shot with our B camera. And that camera, which I believe was just a Sony EX3 that we were doing for things like I was taking it and making a Tri-X 60mm look, and we were doing sort of old film stocks and things, so it was a fine camera for that. In fact, the sensor even matches 16mm. But for this shot, it's low light, and I asked them to shoot it. It's just a locked-off shot, just needed the backstage. They shot it bracketed for me, but they could only go up one stop, and that was it on that camera. So when everybody was done, luckily it was the B camera, so they left it set up, and I just, with nobody looking, sat there and I put my SLR right on top of the camera's matte box and took the matching shot, but I shot them as HDRs, and so that was what I used because it was, otherwise it would have been, had I tried to boost that thing up for fire, it would have been a grainy nightmare. So I was very glad. I mean, in that case, I didn't tell them until later. I don't think the first AC would have been so happy at the time, but it worked out very well.
It's funny that, isn't it? Like the amount of stuff we did on stills, and actually had the director say to me at one point, he's like, man, that still stuff that you're producing is just incredible. What camera are you using? I should get one of those. And I'm saying, and
don't
I
give
know,
any credit to the shooter, huh?
No, he meant it in the nice way, obviously. But it is one of those. Yeah, this camera takes unbelievably good shots. But
it's such a, especially if you, really any of this work, it's such a good way to just refine your skills, to try to compose an interesting shot or match what your cinematic camera is doing.
I literally gave a class at FX PhD and I said, look, the most useful thing I had supervising was a stills camera. And it's not just, as you say, and it's very valid that it refines your skills, but it's also, we used it for HDRs, for textures, for backgrounds. And then we had, a missing shot and we managed to use still elements and then, obviously put a fake kind of move thing in and stuff and matte paintings.
You can save yourself with it. God. Absolutely.
It's just incredible. And, obviously if you're on a mega, mega budget film, there's, tons of footage and it's very rare that you're going to get something better than what you're getting through the main camera. But
plus, you know, having said that, time on set to get what you need.
It's just awesome, just what you can do. And I must admit, I really, really was kind of, I only shot on prime lenses and looking
That's
back
so cool.
now.
So good. Just from all your habits of shooting so much with the red, you just took that right over to the SLR, huh?
Yeah, and it intercut really well with the red, so there you go.
Yeah, no, it's a great discipline. I mean, honestly, don't you find with a zoom camera, you end up going all the way in or out anyway?
Yeah, and also just needing to get down. I really love for my, because I obviously took those sorts of shots. I also sort of cataloged or, I don't know, documented the filmmaking process. And two points about that. One is that I actually made a book, you know, an Apple book. God, mm-hmm. they've got good. And the second thing is that to get those photos that I wanted for myself, the behind-the-scenes shots, the shots that, you know, there was a proper publicity photographer on set, but he's not taking shots of actors in, you know, dressing gowns with reading their scripts kind of in a quiet moment. And that's what I wanted. I wanted those quiet moments. And so just getting it fully open on, like, you know, T2 or thereabouts. And I just can't, you know, my Zoom was like 4.5 to 5.9. Never took it out of the bag because it was just never going to give me that shallow depth of field. And
so you're shooting wide almost exclusively?
Nearly totally shooting fully open on all my... in fact, you know, I'd literally play with ISO and speed to make sure I was sitting on the widest open I could get to get the shallowest depth of field for the portraiture shots I was doing. Yeah. And since then, of course... Well, not of course. Since then, I have bought a much faster zoom. I actually ended up getting a 70 to 200 at 2.9 for... because I just obviously decided now there's no much point in me having a slow zoom because I'm never going to use the darn thing. So I took the bullet, bit the bullet, and bought one that was you know, obviously broke the bank, but was much better, and I will presumably use. But yeah, on set. The other thing is on set, you know, primes are so small. This new zoom I got, which is magnificent, really requires a tripod to use because the thing weighs half a ton, and you know.
Yeah.
I almost topple over.
Front end really heavy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, you prime lenses in a nice little case, you can keep them on you and just, you know, swap them out pretty quickly. And they're very compact, even when you get very good quality ones with, you know, everything you could possibly want in a lens. It's still not a bulky item. So onto that tangent. But yes, I think, you know, you could go on a film set with a, in my opinion, you could go on a film set with a 50 and a 20, a really good 20 without distortion, and happily come off taking with, you know, pretty much, unless it's a outdoor big, you know, Vista kind of show, that and then maybe an 8mm for HDRs, and those three lenses, I could just live happily with just those three. Hey, good talking to you. Sorry, guys, for the rat hole at the end there about photography. But
they know to stop if they're not interested.
Yeah, at least it's up the end. Until next time, we appreciate you guys listening. Thank you so much for downloading. We've had some phenomenal numbers on downloads and stuff over the last period, and we really appreciate that, and we appreciate you guys listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah.